and welcome to the How to Hide a Dead Body podcast. I'm Isaac Rudansky, founder and CEO of Adventure Media, one of New York's fastest growing digital advertising agencies, and I'm joined as always with the great Patrick Gilbert, Adventure Media's executive director and author of Join or Die, Digital Advertising in the Age of Automation, available in paperback and hardcover and digital ebook now on Amazon.com and anywhere books are sold. Patrick, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, Isaac?
Doing good. It's been a busy few weeks. I know we're here to talk about a topic which is a hot topic right now. It impacts a lot of our clients. It impacts probably most people listening to this podcast in some way or another, and that is iOS 14, privacy, Facebook's response, how that's going to impact Facebook, Facebook advertisers, Facebook publishers, or publishers that rely on Facebook, and Google's position and role in all of this. So it's a triangle of complications, of mystery, and politics. And I think it's we bring an interesting angle to the conversation because we many of our clients are Facebook advertisers, and we rely on Facebook's reporting. And there's really not that much clear, obvious information that's been released directly from the major players, i.e. Google, Facebook, and Apple. So it's been up to people like us who are sort of in the trenches, so to speak, to try to parse this information out and to figure out what it means for our people and ourselves. So why don't you kick us off here and set the stage for what we're going to be talking about?
Sure. So we almost recorded something on this topic probably 2 months ago. This has been something that's been in the news and it's been in the industry conversations for a while now. And it's been about a year since Google originally announced that they're going to be moving to a cookie-less environment. So this idea of a cookie-less world has sort of been a buzzword for the last year. And it's been really hard for us to get our hands around everything. And only recently have we made some headway. And that's why I'm finally confident to talk about it. And we rarely talk about these types of topics, like news stories related to the digital advertising space, at least as far as the podcast is concerned, because I think a lot of these things, they don't have a lot of shelf life and they don't really impact a lot of what we do. Like, yes, a new update here or a new, you know, news story will impact some of the day-to-day of what we work on. But everything that's happening right now with with iOS 14, with Facebook, with Google, with privacy, with cookies, is not just a quick news story. This is changing the entire landscape. It is something that will be around for a long time, and it's forcing us to think differently about how we're developing campaign strategy. So therefore, it makes it much more important to discuss. And even from a broader perspective, the idea of data and privacy rights is all over. Last night, I was driving home from work, and I tuned into a Clubhouse room where a bunch of, like, former athletes and people that work in, like, sports journalism were debating the privacy topic for athletes and what sort of data do athletes have access to. And honestly, like, everyone's just asking questions that no one else has a really good answer to. And there's so many different people that are involved in this conversation. It impacts advertisers, it impacts agencies, it impacts athletes on the ground floor, it impacts C-level executives, it impacts society as a whole. So I think what's really important is we all have to establish more common ground. And I think that's where what we're trying to do with this episode is try and like take a lot of this information and make it digestible for the average marketer to understand. So we have a few recommendations as far as like what you should look at after this podcast, and I will we'll give those recommendations toward the end. But I think what our real goal here is like, okay, there's a lot going on. It's a lot of technical jargon. It's a lot of broader societal debate. But what can we as Adventure Media do to help decode a lot of this jargon for the average person so that they can go on and contribute to this conversation in a more sophisticated way? My main takeaway, and I'm curious what you think, Isaac, is that there's a lot of warning signs going out and people are are hitting the panic button. And there are certain folks that this certainly should be doing that for, that level of panic. But I would say by and large, the majority of advertisers, particularly the ones that we work with, really don't have much to worry about. This whole transition will change a lot of what we do, but it's not going to make Facebook irrelevant. It's not going to diminish the value of Google as an advertising platform. We just need to understand how this is going to change and adapt. But do you have any other, like, kind of broader takeaway thoughts before we dive in?
Yeah. I want to also clarify a couple things. And you were telling me the other, you were talking to me about this a few months ago, how it's a good idea to show an audience where you're going at the beginning of a presentation, and then you get them there. So let's just try to set expectations to the audience now where we're going, because there's a lot of different places in this debate that we could go. I don't think we're going to get hyper technical. Like, we're not, you and I are not developers. But we're going to try to be as open and as practical as possible with, like, what is actually happening and what does it really mean. But let's just define a couple of brief things. You said that you used the term a cookie-less world. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of people who like cookies don't want to live in a cookie-less world. So we have to we have to describe what you mean by a cookie. And just very briefly and simply, a cookie is an alphanumeric string of numbers and letters that is placed on either your device or in the cloud when you go to visit a website. Let's just say, for example, or you open up an app. Let's say I was using this example the other day. I'm on a diet. It's not apparent yet, but it's an early. I only just started, so I use this app called MyFitnessPal. I happened to went and splurged for the premium. This is actually relevant. I went and bought the premium version for $20 a year, so I'm not exposed to ads. And this is important because the majority of the impact that these changes are going to have are on in-app ads. And I want to just define what in-app ad means as well while I'm defining what a cookie is. An in-app ad is just as it sounds. It's an ad you see when you're inside an app. Typically, you see a lot of ads in games. And you see ads in apps, but, like, imagine you download an app. It might be the Spotify app. It might be MyFitnessPal. So MyFitnessPal has lots of ads until I paid the $20 a year to remove ads. So that cookie is there's a cookie placed on my phone or in the cloud that identifies me not by my name or my address or any what we call PII, personally identifiable information, and then that alphanumeric string is shared with lots of other companies and websites and ad platforms. And as I continue to use internet-connected devices and I visit other websites and I watch certain YouTube videos and I listen to certain Spotify playlists, my cookie sends rich information about me to all sorts of different people and companies, but, for example, an ad network. Or a company like Facebook or Google that will allow an advertiser to identify me as a certain type of person interested in certain types of things and certain types of products. That's really what the cookie functions to do at a very, very simple level. And there's been a lot of the debate around cookies is, are these cookies revealing too much information about me? Are they being shared with too many people? And we hear the word creepy, right? The non-technical users say creepy a lot. It's like the ads could be so targeted that it's almost creepy. Like, what was it, Patrick, you were showing me the other day? We were talking about going somewhere. You were, like, going upstate New York somewhere. You know, remember this?
We had a call with a client that's in Montana, and then I started getting Instagram ads that say, visit Montana, and it was the weirdest thing.
Right, and by now, like, probably everyone listening has had these types of experiences. And that's related to cookies. Like, that happening is part of the cookie technology, because the advertiser who then places the Come Visit Montana ad is paying to leverage to access the information stored, or paying to access your cookie, so basically. Okay, so that's a hopefully simplified understanding of what a cookie is. If you happen to ever hear the word pixel, pixels are tightly related to cookies, because pixels are the piece of code that place the cookie on your browser. or on your device or in the cloud, in large match tables in the cloud. Okay. In-app advertising is where the biggest impact is happening here, because I want to just define, or at least constrict the hysteria a little bit. These changes happening in iOS 14. Did you, okay, so maybe we'll wait because we'll describe
Yeah,
what
we'll
is
come back to
iOS
that.
14 doing, and then we'll come back to that. So I wanted to just define that at a simple level, and then just one last thing. There's four key categories of in-app ads that customers are typically, or app users are typically exposed to. Rewarded ads, and those are these really annoying ads that you beat a level of Temple Run, and now I need to wait 60 seconds to watch a video before I could continue. Those are often also called interstitial ads, and those ads often show up in a different format where you could choose, instead of having to buy more coins or buy more life or buy upgrades, you could watch video ads for like 60 seconds and you'll get those upgrades. Right? So those are ads, and it's like, I mean, this part of why I think that this all these changes are going to be ultimately good for the industry, because Google writes on their AdMob website. AdMob is the most popular product that exists that app developers use to place ads inside their apps, and they wrote innovative ad formats like rewarded and native ads help balance user experience with monetization to keep users happy and engaged. No one is happy when they have to watch 60-second ads to like get to the next level of a game or like open up my meal counter so I could track like the calories that I ate. Okay. Then you have native ads, which are they exist online also, but when they're inside an app, you could be scrolling through. We could go back to my example of MyFitnessPal. MyFitnessPal has a blog feature inside the app with like articles and tips for like recipes and healthy living and whatever. And native ads would be sponsored placements that look like a typical post, right? They're sort of disguised and camouflaged.
Basically,
Banner
most
ads.
Facebook ads are made to look like native ads. That's essentially the
Yeah.
easiest way to.
Right. Like exactly. It looks like it's something in your news feed. Which reminds me of a really funny story. When I was sitting with Baruch Leifer, we were looking at Reddit shower thoughts, and like Reddit shower thoughts are like really funny and like they're really deep, like it's like a shower thought, like something like a really interesting but funny observation about the world. One of them was like, when sharks smell blood in the water, it's like you walking past your neighborhood, your neighbor's like barbecue, like smelling a barbecue. It's like the same feeling, like shower thoughts. So they all take it. Sometimes they take a second to really get. So and he had never seen them. So he was scrolling through, and like he's cracking up and laughing, and we're like whatever. And then he's stuck on one for like 6 minutes. He's like, I don't get it. I don't get it. Like, what is so fun? Like, I and I'm like, and then he's like, oh my God, it's an ad. It was like an ad for like a mortgage, for like a some mortgage product. And we were cracking up.
That's
So that's
funny.
native, right? And then you have banner ads, which are everyone knows are like rectangular ads that, by the way, are very insidious because you. I mean, I don't know how large the average human thumb is. My thumb cannot hit the X button on a banner ad inside an app. So I always cost the advertiser money, and this goes back to part of why I think this is good for the industry in general, because these are not good ad products. So I end up pressing X. Not only do I cost the advertiser money by clicking on an ad that's not relevant to me, I also have a poor experience because I end up then being redirected to another site and have to come back to the app. Those are banner ads. And then interstitial ads where, you're scrolling through images of an actor on IMDb and every third image is an ad, right? Like that's what would be considered an interstitial ad. So those are like, just to give a visualized practical sense of what we're talking about here, and what's going to be impacted. And those ads have become very, very targeted because Facebook collects and Google collect a lot of data. And I really like that example from Foxwood Digital. He said it's like a dam. Apple, being the manufacturer of the device that these apps are installed on, they sort of operate the floodgates. They could put a stop to or open up the flow of information that takes place from within these ads to the advertisers, to the companies like Facebook that wants to use them and to monetize, and to target their ad products based on the information. So Apple is in a very, very strong position, while Google and Android and the Google Play Store are certainly a large, I don't know the exact percentage, maybe you know, Patrick, like what percentage of app users or apps installed, Apple still has the lion's share, I think, as far as app activity in the world or in the United States goes, for sure. Google's definitely not nothing, but this does not impact. So everything we're talking about here doesn't really impact all of advertising that's taking place inside apps on Google phones, right? So that's an interesting point. Everything we're talking about is only impacting app developers who are making money from their apps that are being downloaded on Apple's phones, because this is an iOS 14 update. Apple's sort of taking the charge here. As of right now, if you're making money and you're advertising inside apps that people are using on a Samsung Galaxy, which is an Android phone, there's no real change right now, although there has been chatter that I've seen about like Google taking certain steps also, but we'll see how that plays out. Right now, like, we're talking about iOS 14. So that's just I'll kick it back to you now.
Okay, and I think one very important caveat of everything you just described, when we talk about apps, it's all apps. It's not just a Temple Run game. It's your Facebook app and your Instagram app. So if you're going to be serving ads inside of the Instagram app, which it's like 95% plus of like Instagram engagement is done within the Instagram app as opposed to the desktop experience. So that's why this is funneled through there. Most people just think of Instagram as a product and don't really think of it in terms of, well, this is actually a product that I access through my Apple device. And that actually comes back to the crux of why this happened in the first place. Right. So,
although can I just give a caveat on your caveat?
Sure.
Because I think it's an interesting point. Facebook's app itself, the data Facebook could collect on you when you're inside Facebook or Instagram, because they own Instagram, are actually not being impacted. That's something that
right,
I learned.
So we'll get to that.
You're going to recommend that podcast, episode 292, but that's something that I learned from that iOS 14's updates don't impact the first-party data Facebook could collect from you as long as you're interacting within Facebook's app.
Right. However, sorry, we're totally going off the rails here, and I promise to the listeners here that might be kind of confused. We'll circle back and put a bow on all this. But to that last point, Isaac, the majority of the data that Facebook collects and uses to both report on advertising campaigns and also optimize for advertising performance is collected outside of the Facebook ecosystem. It's collected from third-party sites, which is why all of this is so crazy, detrimental, whatever word you want to use. So let's try and – we just covered a lot of technical definitions and details. Let's try and walk through the story of what's actually happening here. So
let's do it.
Apple. Everyone's familiar with Apple. They're a pretty big company. So the whole thing here with Apple tracking is that – so they have the App Store, which is essentially the way that people that use Instagram on their phone are accessing the Instagram interface. When you go into a app on your Apple device and make a purchase, because it's through the App Store protocol, Apple is charging a 30% tax to the company that administered, that is kind of monetizing that event. So let me give you an example. When you download the Netflix app and you sign up for a Netflix account on your Apple device, Apple will forever take 30% of your subscription that goes back through your Netflix account, which is why a company like Netflix is very much incentivized to try and get you to sign up for your service on Netflix.com directly. Because the Netflix app is technically being run through Apple, so they want to put their hand in the jar. Apple's putting their hand in the jar to collect the 30% tax when you sign up through the app. But if you go to Netflix directly and sign up for your subscription, they will not take a fee on that. So over time, 30% is a lot of money, and if you remember from this past summer, there was a big news story about Epic, which is the company that controls the game Fortnite. there was a big clash where Fortnite or Epic was trying to take Apple to the Supreme Court and all these other things because 30% is just egregious, so on and so forth. So this has been like a big topic in just the digital like commerce space for a very long time. And a lot of companies, Facebook in particular, have been trying to figure out ways to get back some of this revenue that they've just been kind of giving back to Apple all of these years. Okay, so that's kind of like the very beginning of all of this. Now, the second part of it now is when we talk about Facebook directly. They've been drifting out of their lane in terms of like pushing the boundaries of this rule. So Apple says, you know, any monetization through your app needs to, like, we'll take a 30% tax on. Also, you cannot, like, no companies are allowed to have their own app store within their app that is accessed on an iOS device. Meaning, there cannot be an app store within Facebook that looks like the Apple app store. Apple will kick Facebook off their platform if that happens, because that's basically them trying to do the same thing. They're trying to monetize this whole thing. So Facebook has drifted out of their lane by essentially creating their own sort of app store experience and like not directly monetizing through their through the iOS app. They've been pushing the boundaries of this over the years. They have their own Facebook shops. They have all these different game interfaces that is basically an app store, but they're pushing the boundaries to what that really means. And it's basically been pissing off Apple. So Facebook has been able to generate more revenue from their users, and they've squeezed Apple out of the picture. So obviously this pisses off Apple. And at the same time, the Apple App Store over the last 10 years, like I didn't even realize this until I started like researching this topic. The Apple App Store is like virtually worthless at this point. If you remember 15 years ago, or maybe that's too long of a stretch of time, but like 10 years ago, when I first got my, you know, the first iPhone that I had, the Apple App Store was everything. Like the featured list on the App Store, like made or it was king, they were kingmakers. It like it was everything to be featured on the App Store. Now, I can't tell you the last time I went to the App Store. The App Store itself on Apple is nothing but just like an annoying step that you need to take when you go to download an app that you probably heard about from a Facebook ad. So it's like, oh, you generally you learn about new ads because of you learn about new apps because you saw an ad for them on Google or Facebook. You click through that, it brings you to the Apple App Store, and it's like, oh, this is so annoying, I have to download it. And now you're able to access the app. So the Apple App Store itself has essentially become worthless, which diminishes the power that Apple has, which further pisses them off. With me so far, Isaac?
Yes.
Excellent. So, in June of last year, June of 2020, Apple announced the plans for the iOS 14 update, which will include new restrictions in terms of data privacy. So now, everything that I just spoke about in terms of like the Apple versus Facebook feud and like why Facebook's drifting out of their lane, that's not written anywhere. That's not like, you know, Apple didn't say that they're doing all this because of that. That's just speculation. And most people that have been writing about this topic have sort of agreed that that's what's led to this. Apple now, and these ads started months ago where they started talking about how they care about your privacy. Apple figured out that it would be very advantageous for them to take a position that they care about your privacy more than any of the other big tech companies. And they can blame Facebook for basically everything that's happened in society. And they can blame Amazon for other things. And they can blame Google for other things. But they, Apple, they care about your data. Which is partially true. If you remember a few years back, there was like this big debate whether or not Apple should let the FBI decode this like terrorist phone. So they have sort of cared about this, but never to the extent that they've gone about this over the last 6 months. They found that it would be advantageous from a PR perspective, from a marketing perspective, to say, we're the privacy people. So that's the note they're going off of. iOS 14, it's a new... It has a new set of rules and regulations as far as what data can be tracked, including forced use of what's called the IDFA, which is an identifier for advertisers. The IDFA is what users it is what users will it's a prompt that users will see that will say, do you want, Facebook.com wants to be able to track your data. Do you grant them permission, yes or no? That prompt is essentially the IDFA, allowing users to choose whether or not they can be identified and tracked by the app that they are downloading. This has been around for a long time, but it's never really been forced upon everybody. Now, as part of this new wave of what Apple is enforcing, they are making that mandatory. So in June when this came out, Facebook was like, okay, not a big deal. I'll just not show the prompt. Like, whatever. Like, if it's not that big of a deal. Apple eventually came out with what's called the ATT, the what is app tracking transparency. I keep forgetting what it actually stands for. App tracking transparency. It's basically their stance saying that like anybody that's going to track any data on an iOS app needs to show the IDFA prompt and give users the option to not have their personally identifiable information tracked.
It's even more. It's by default now, the app developer has to not track any information, and the IDFA prompt is giving the users to opt in to tracking. Which that's when Facebook got so up in arms because like, why would you like? If I'm already tracked into tracking, maybe I'll just leave it or X out of the prompt and be like, okay. But now that I have to click a button to allow tracking. That's when Facebook realized that like most people probably won't allow tracking because they don't really understand the value of the tracking. It just sounds creepy to the average person. Like tracking doesn't sound good to anybody. Like no
No.
one wants to be tracked. So like, yeah, go ahead.
So, and I forget what this terminology is offhand, but there actually is separate terminology that Apple uses when they prompt their own users to opt into tracking. And I forget what it is, and offhand, and I have to, I'll look it up and I'll, I don't know, put it on Twitter or
What
something,
do you
but
mean your own
basically.
users for like Apple-owned apps?
Apple-owned app. So when you go to download Instagram now, or when you go to refresh Instagram, you're going to get a prompt that says, "Do you give Instagram permission to track behavioral data or whatever it is?" It's pretty agree. It's like pretty like it makes you say no. The terminology that Apple uses to show for their own apps is much lighter, per se, which like that by itself is just completely. It's infuriating to me. And separately, like I think that it came out the other day, there's a antitrust lawsuit in France where they're bring against Apple because they're basically doing this and they're exploiting their own customers for all this stuff. But Eric Seufert, who runs a site called Mobile Dev Memo, he's kind of been like he's been sitting in the middle of this entire privacy debate and has probably been the most influential and outspoken educational person that's really helped. His content has helped me learn about this. He had a really good point where he was like, why can't Apple's terminology say something like, do you allow Instagram to track your data? Data tracking allows or allows brands to keep their content free. Like, why can't you just explain why? Like, wouldn't like do we like advertising? Do we hate advertising as much as we like? Or do we hate advertising more than we want to pay for things? Generally not, because that's why the advertising industry exists to begin with, because we're not.
This goes back to the whole your whole point in the beginning, which is why Eric Suffer's point is, to me, fine, but not really relevant because Apple is looking to find a competitive advantage to what their business is, and fair enough. Right, like they're positioning themselves as a hardware company that has really good privacy controls. And we're not when the FBI wants to, when the FBI wants to crack the password of a terrorist's phone, we won't do it because there's nothing more important to us than privacy. And that's their marketing thing. That's their shtick. And they're the, and look, they're the one of the world's largest companies with smart people. So that's why they're gonna they're, that's that when they get up in court, they're gonna say, look, we don't have to use the same type of language in our apps because our apps like we collect like we like that's they're inside one of our apps. When you're using Keynote on your phone, you're already inside our privacy vault, And like, we're not doing much with your tracking other than like crash reports. I'm just giving examples.
Yeah.
But like a third party app, we have to be much, much more careful for the safety of our users. It's like, I own a house. Let's imagine that's like the device. Now I have a nanny who's raised, was like part of my life since I was 4 years old. My family trusts her and like, she's awesome. And like, okay, so we give her the alarm code. Now we have a new babysitter. She looks the same. She acts the same. She has the same title, but she doesn't get the alarm code. It's like, well, why? Like they're the same. And Apple will say like, no, they're not the same. Like one of them is part of our family. The other one is not. It's like Apple's going to make that claim. And to Eric Zuffer's point, which is, well, why can't you just like encourage people that tracking is anonymous, educate them? Because Apple doesn't want to educate you about tracking. Apple wants the competitive advantage of more people relying and needing Apple's ecosystem and Apple's devices. And, you know, Facebook's a real threat. Google's a real threat to Apple in other ways that maybe we understand some of it or not all of it. Like these are complicated businesses that overlap in complicated ways. So yeah, Apple's not going to be like encouraging you to opt in to help Facebook, you know, Facebook's advertising machine do any better.
You're right, and it's infuriating to me because honestly, like people really take advertising for granted. I mean, this is totally me on my soapbox, and you know, I'm very biased on this, but
it's your podcast, man. This is your soapbox.
We take for granted that like things are available to be free. Because advertising exists, and advertising can exist if you're willing to give up the fact that you advanced to level 2 in Temple Run. Like, is that you're not your credit card information is not being siphoned into Temple Run and into Facebook? Whatever. Okay, wait. I'll close the soapbox out at least for now. I'm sure we'll circle back to it. So, yeah. As far as what does this mean for Facebook? So now, really, everyone that has an app is being impacted by this. But Facebook is an app that collects a lot of data and across multiple apps, not just theirs, and uses that data to help create a monetization engine for in advertising. So going back to a previous point, and this is an important piece, the majority of the data that Facebook uses is not collected inside Instagram and is not collected inside Facebook. It's collected from third-party websites. It's generated from Walmart.com, and it's generated from the random Shopify site and your WordPress account and that person's Magento site and every other website on the internet. Because what happens is when people opt into Facebook advertising and they put the Facebook pixel on their website, they have to agree to terms and conditions. And as part of those terms and conditions, it allows Facebook to grab your data, which... Okay, so now say you're a Shopify store, you're a small business, and you're running a t-shirt company, and you say, I want to run Facebook ads, and I want to track conversions and create retargeting pools, from my Facebook thing, so I need to put the pixel on my site. Okay, great. You're telling Facebook now that you're giving people access to you're giving Facebook access to your data. So they can use that to better inform their own optimization algorithms and reporting and all that good stuff. The same happens with Google Analytics. Every single website on the internet that has Google Analytics on the website, including Adventure Media's website, is helping give data back to Google that isn't just for reporting. Google doesn't let people get Google Analytics tags for free because they want to do good for the world. They let you create a Google Analytics account for free because they want to be able to use the data that you're getting on your site. Sure, Google Analytics is a very useful tool. People use it to make incredibly important strategic decisions, but it's a mutual, like instead of paying Google for access to Google Analytics, you're basically paying them in terms of your users' data. And that is a very overlooked piece of this whole puzzle, because as these things get complicated and people opt out of apps, you have to realize that, you know, Facebook in particular is extremely reliant on the data that they're acquiring from everywhere else on the web, not just Instagram and Facebook.
Should we talk about like our client, the types of clients we work with, like, you know, direct response, e-commerce businesses, service-based businesses, and talk about the impact, like to how Facebook reporting might change and what that really means?
I would say let's get back to that toward the end. So okay. The next thing here, we covered like where this, you know, this data is being taken away. So to one of your earlier points, Isaac, any information within Facebook that you can glean from Facebook is extremely important, as well as your first party data. So if you have a customer list of your customers and you can leverage that data in Facebook, that's going to be extremely valuable. These are some things that are going to change. But as far as like how all of this works and what's going to happen when these cookies are deprecated, I totally didn't really understand any of this until Google came out with their announcement last week about their privacy sandbox and their Flocks and all this other stuff that's taking place.
Okay, Isaac, let's
do you want to explain that?
You walk us through that for a minute, and then walk us through Google, like how they make money through advertising, and what is a flock, and what does it mean for them to not have cookies? Go ahead.
Cool. So Google has their own advertising platform, as probably anyone listening to this knows. And it's Google Search, but it's also, they have their own display network advertising. And so, you know, ads that can be served on the New York Times website and within apps, you know, the Temple Run app and all these other things, like whatever.
And so that's, just to mention that what I mentioned earlier in the episode, AdMob, which is the most popular exchange for in-app advertising, is owned by Google. It's a Google product.
Right. So they certainly monetize as well. What makes Google unique compared to Facebook or any other platform that's being impacted by this is that Google has much more first-party data than anyone else. So when we said earlier, okay, anything within the Facebook app is technically Facebook's first-party data. So if you're interacting with Instagram, and by the way, we use Facebook and Instagram interchangeably because they're essentially the same thing, just a different interface. When you follow certain accounts on Instagram, Facebook is using that data to give a profile of who you are, because that's their data. That's first party data. As an Instagram user, you're agreeing to that. What they can't do is pull from a third party. Now that's limited though. Like there's only so many things that you can glean from inside Facebook and inside Instagram. Google though has access to a lot more data that's their own. So if you use the Chrome browser, which I think last I checked is the most popular browser. Maybe I'm wrong. Double check me on that. Chrome is extremely popular browser. Whatever. It's one of the top three. A lot of people in the world use Google Chrome as their browser of choice. Anything in there can be tracked by Google. Anything inside of an Android operating system, which is the number two market share, is being tracked by Google. Anything within a Google-owned app, like Google Maps, or Gmail to an extent. Google doesn't read your emails. They just they track certain behavioral patterns. Anything in YouTube that you do, it's owned by Google. So they get to use that to their advantage. Whereas like Facebook doesn't have this huge amount of data sets to work with. So they're at a significant advantage. Google came out last week in early March, depending on when you're listening to this. So it was early March saying, here's our plans for the cookieless world. We're actually going to get rid of cookies altogether. And we're going to specifically rely on server-side applications that are not going to upload any data to the cloud. In Isaac's previous example, where he had that cookie assigned to him that basically was taking information and feeding information back as he navigated to different websites, Google is now saying, we are only going to look at data when you're in the moment interacting with a given website. And when you leave that website, when you leave Google Chrome, we're not saving any of your data. And we have our own systems to like make sure that we're doing the right thing. So that's basically them saying, we're not going to track you. We're not going to follow you around without your consent. We're going to play nice, and we're going to meet all of the outcries of all the people for privacy. Now, this sounds great in theory, but what they're also doing here is the way that they're still going to make advertising-informed decisions is by assigning individuals to what's called a flock. And it stands for a federated learning of cohorts, which is honestly, just think of a flock as like a buyer persona. It's probably the easiest way to look at it.
I'm thinking of like geese.
It's sort of like a flock of geese. But so you gave your example earlier, that you downloaded a fitness app or a dieting app, whatever. So that's like a data point that Google can know about you to better inform where you should fit in the grand scheme of things. But let me give a different example here. The funny thing about flocks is, like, it's very hard to give an example that doesn't make you seem like you're, like, judging people. But let's just assume for a second that there's a woman named Mary that buys a lot of organic food, and she has young kids at home, and she, is into clean, like, non-pesticide cleaning products, and all these other, there's all these different attributes that make Mary unique, very similar to the buyer persona thing. Now, Google can track Mary's behavior as she's interacting with Google's apps, and Google will slap a label on her and say, okay, she's Organic Mary. And instead of having a name, it's like a long string of numbers. That's the flock. Great. Now, the next time Mary goes to a different website, Google can know that Mary is Organic Mary. She's in that flock, but they won't know how she got added into that flock. They won't know that she's added into that flock because she was recently buying organic products for her kids.
That's what I don't get. Can I ask a clarification question?
Sure.
There's Mary. Let's make the labels a little simpler, like, because we don't want it. Mary's the person, and let's just say the flock name is Organic Charlotte.
Okay.
Okay? Because you're gonna have a lot of people that, because otherwise, that's the idea here, right? Like, we're moving away from an individual into
Right, groups.
A flock of group of people. So now Mary, who's the actual person, she has to have taken X number, she has to have done X number of things before Google is comfortable or confident enough in statistical terms to apply her to the organic Charlotte flock. With me so far?
Yes, and the Charlotte thing is probably confusing. Let's just say organic mothers, as far as what this flock is. A group of people, Google says it's going to be at
Fine.
least more than 1,000 people, so organic mothers is what the flock is called.
Okay. Great. It sounds like a great name for a milk. If Patrick, if we ever sell Adventure
Organic
Media,
mothers.
we'll start a milk company. It's we're gonna call it Organic Mothers.
Perfect. So you're
Okay.
basically
Okay.
saying,
So
like,
now,
where does that first flock come from? I don't really know about like how this
no, but
transition
is that
works.
no? Two right. So two. No. So I don't need to know how. Okay. There's but or but Mary has to do enough things, but Google's tracking those things that Mary's doing. Are they no longer tracking Mary as she goes through websites and with a cookie? Like, how is Google, is it because Google just has enough connected devices that there's enough data points that Google already owns that they don't no longer need to use like an actual cookie on your hard drive? They just know it from their own first party data. Is that it?
Yes, and the difference is when you have a cookie, that information is being uploaded to the cloud, and that a cookie is basically a digital ID or a name tag that
Right.
every time Mary shows up to a new website, the website goes, "Oh, it's Mary." Okay, we know we can and okay, so and let me be clear here. It's not the website doing that. Every time Mary shows up to a website, Google can use their Google Analytics tag to know, oh, this is Mary. We've seen her before. We know that she was buying organic cookies last week. Which is very different. So that's the individualized tracking that we currently have with cookies. But in the flock system, Mary will show up to your website and Google will say, oh, this is an organic mother. And make a bunch of assumptions about who this is, who Mary is, based on that. Now, if she buys something, if she whatever, that information in that session is not going to be uploaded to the cloud and stored forever as part of her digital name tag.
All right, so it's still a little confusing, but it sounds like, to simplify it, Google has gotten big enough or pervasive enough that they have enough touch points where they no longer need to use this cookie technology, because also the cookie was something which was shared amongst lots of different companies. It was bought, it was traded like a stock in a way. Because let's say
Well, hang
if
on, no,
Mary
but
bought.
it's cookie information is not being sold. Like personal data has never been sold by Google or by Facebook or by anybody. And that's a big misconception with all this data stuff. None of these companies are selling data. They sell ad inventory that uses the data to place the ads.
Right. So what I mean is, let's say Mary, she bought cookies last week, and that information is stored within her cookie. And then she comes to a website. Let's say she's using Safari, and there's, maybe it's AdRoll or Criteo, or there's some other tracking tag that could read the cookie, but Google, which owns DoubleClick, which is another huge ad exchange, is licensing the right to read that cookie to place a bid in the auction, right? They're not reading Mary's personal information. They're paying, I guess you can call it licensing fees, to all these other partner technologies to read this cookie about Mary, and decide how much to bid and what ads to bid and so on and so forth. And it's a whole complicated group of technologies that are involved in that process. So now Google's saying, look, we don't really need that cookie anymore, because we'll know enough about Mary to put her into a specific enough group of like people, and we could just do away with cookies, and our advertising will be just as effective.
It's group-based targeting, not individual.
Relevant, yeah. But I guess my point of confusion is still, like, there... I have 2 points.
I'll give you a different example. Maybe this will clear up some of the confusion, right? So let's say Mary, she's in this cohort. She's in this flock that's organic mothers. And Google doesn't know how she got there in real time, right? Google doesn't know how you got onto a flock because it's not tracking the history. It's just tracking real-time information. So now you get a label slapped on your head. So now when you show up to this website, it's like, oh, cool, organic mother. Here's how we value organic mothers. But now let's say you buy something on that website. Google's now learning. It's observing in real time what's called a privacy sandbox. That's the terminology. They're using like the server-side application to look at what's happening in real time and say, oh, she bought, I don't know, something. She's not just an organic mother. She's an organic young mother. And that's a different flock. So now Mary's cohort flock has changed. So now she gets a new label slapped on her head that the next time she shows up to a different website, she's no longer just organic mother. She's in this different flock altogether. So it's using the machine learning capabilities and the data that it's ingesting. It's still tracking information. Google's still tracking information about what you're doing, who you are. It's just trying to refine that over time to get better information about who you are.
Right, and they're saying
best fits your buying habits.
So I think the way to describe it is Google still knows as much about you as they always knew, because they have to if they know enough about you to put you in flocks and to change you from flock to flock and to put you on multiple flocks and so on and so forth. They have to know all these individual things about you. But their claim is that we're no longer using an individual profile when we decide to show you what ad. We're going to use your group identity.
Exactly.
So remember, I posted this to our company Slack the other day, and I'll just reiterate this point here because I don't know if it made any sense, and I still don't know if it makes any sense. But what I think my take on this is that it's really no fundamental change to what Google has always been doing.
Nope, and that's why it's brilliant.
This is not. I don't find it evil or wrong that companies are looking for angles with which to market themselves. You know, great. And you know, sometimes you have to please the public, and sometimes you're a large company, and you want to make your customers happy, and you want to play nice, and you want to. And it's a big balancing act, and they have smart people figuring all this stuff out. However, here's why I don't think it's any different. Like, because it's like, oh wow, you were able to use individual data points from a person's entire internet history or however long the cookies last. I'm not a cookie expert. I told you I'm on a diet.
That's the second time you've made a cookie joke, and it's
funny.
Throwing me off entirely.
No.
Still not funny. Maybe the third time. They're still
there. We'll see. We can have a vote.
Okay.
Where was I? So they're like, oh, so Google's like, okay, we're not going to use, so people are like, wow, I was able to, the whole idea of internet, of like online targeting was individualized targeting, individual, and now Google's going to groups, and like, I'm like, it's just like group identities, it's not going to be as relevant and as targeted and as intent-based, and it's like, no, Google has always been doing group targeting. Let's say I want to figure out, because what is the really interesting value of internet targeting? Predicted conversion rate. That's the genius behind all of these technologies, and that's really the Shangri-La that these companies are trying to get to. Is how accurately can I predict your likelihood to convert and after you click an ad? Because that will get you to the exact economically true bid on behalf of your advertiser. Now, predicted conversion rate is not a perfect science because you have to predict human behavior. So it's all about predicting human behavior based on what you know about that person. But it's also based on what you know about people. So if you're hungry, Patrick, right? Let's say you're hungry.
I'm always
hungry. I will. And this is not a cookie joke. I'm being totally serious here. Let's say you're hungry, and I was asked by my psych professor, like, can you predict how Patrick will respond to his hunger? I will have a much better time. I will more accurately predict how you respond to your hunger by looking at how other people, not you, how other people have responded to their similar situations of hunger more accurately than I'll look at all of your past behaviors that you manifest in other situations, like when you were not hungry. Like, I'll learn more about your personal likelihood to react to being hungry by looking at other similar people's reactions to being hungry than I will about learning about your previous behaviors, like your movie preferences and tastes and all of your other previous behaviors, which is interesting because I could learn more about you by looking at other people than I can by looking at you. So Google has always, and that's just like fundamentally true, like similar people will behave in similar situations similarly, whereas an individual will manifest a huge range of behaviors based on circumstance. So, meaning we're more alike than we are different than each other, especially when you have a flock of like an age group and an income bracket and a geographical location and a time of day, fine, so on and so forth, which is what Google's probably using to identify groups. So all I'm saying is that Google has when Google looks at predicted conversion rate, how will you react to this ad at this time? They're looking at how other people like you have reacted to similar circumstances, and they always have been, and which is why I think it's like probably very little or zero fundamental change to how Google has been trying to figure out predicted conversion rate all along.
I agree. I think from a machine learning perspective, it actually simplifies the entire equation because instead of looking at the largest data set that is totally incomprehensible and trying to figure out which are the signals that matter most, if you're trying to look at group behavior, it's easier to look at a trend of all these different signals together in mass and then make a prediction based on what the entire group is. It's not necessarily better or worse. It's just different and likely simpler, and can do it kind of at scale. And like, people really underestimate the power of data and machine learning, and that's really what it is. So the fact that Google came out over this past week or whatever and said, hey, listen, like this, we're just going to do this entirely. We're going to, you know, look at us. They wouldn't have done so if they weren't so confident and excited in the solution that they have here. And that's really good for them, and it's good for a lot of our clients that things weren't worse for them. So let's bring this back to Facebook.
Okay.
Because now, like, what's interesting to me is that I've understood this entire thing a lot better once I can compare the differences between what's happening with Google and what's happening in Facebook. So everything that we just discussed regarding Google essentially gets to the point of like, Google's going to be fine. They have these flocks. They have this different privacy sandbox thing. They're not going to be deprecated by privacy legislation, this, that, or whatever, even though they probably should be. Whatever, that's a separate topic. But they're probably going to be fine, and their advertising is going to continue to be powerful. Why is it so different for Facebook? And it comes down to what I said earlier. It's the lack of first-party data. It's the lack of being able to track data across those third-party sites and their own limited amount of first-party data that they have access to. So does this mean, is this a nail in the coffin for Facebook as an advertising platform? I would say no. I'm still extremely, maybe bullish isn't the word, but we're certainly not going to start pulling our clients' ad spend off of Facebook. The difference here is that most businesses have not been utilizing all the different tools inside Facebook that are really going to be taking away. Most businesses are using like pretty simple interest targeting and, you know, email lists and like a 1% lookalike audience and like all these different things. They're not leveraging 300 conversion actions that have different incremental values at every stage depending on how far you're advancing into a game. Like, that's very sophisticated stuff that is like really going to get complicated in the future. But if you're just a standard, if you're an e-commerce business, if you're a SaaS company, If you're a law firm, if you are an educational institution, you're going to be able to be fine. It's going to be challenging, but you can be fine. And here's basically the technical aspects of what we mean by this and what needs to be done in the future. Facebook, as they move away from the pixel and the cookies and everything that they're doing there, they're going to, we need to now lean on what's called the Conversions API, which is abbreviated to CAPI. So whenever you hear people talking about CAPI, they're referring to this thing called the Conversions API, which is essentially their own version of like their own like browser within a browser. So when you go to Google Chrome and instead of like the traditional sense is like, okay, you go to a Shopify website and they have the Facebook pixel on there, but the information is only being fed into the pixel through a cookie. So when that cookie goes, and then once it gets into the pixel, it goes into the cloud, and then Facebook can then pull it down. When you're using the Conversions API, it's what's called a server-side application, that it's pulling that information directly from that browser and directly depositing it into Facebook in real time. So this is similar to what we were talking about before, where Google's not like storing this information over time through the cloud. It's directly going back to Facebook. So that's good. That's a good sign. So you have to install the Conversions API to really track any data moving forward. That's number one. The second thing that they're implementing is that you need to verify your domain within your Facebook Business Manager. This is, if you've ever worked with the Google Merchant Center, it's a similar type of idea. Facebook's trying to cut down the amount of like nefarious websites that are advertising with different domains and all this other stuff. So that's step two. Basically, you can only have one ad account per website domain, which is going to be complicated for advertisers that use like landing pages and lead pages and all these different things. I don't really know what the next thing with that is, but again, not a lot of information about out on this yet. But for the standard business owner, you need to verify your domain in the Facebook Business Manager. The third implication is that advertisers will now be limited in Facebook to 8 conversion events. Historically, you were allowed to set up as many conversion events and track as much individual event sequences as you would like. Now Facebook is limiting, is capping that number at 8. I have no idea why it's 8, but it's 8. Most businesses that we've worked with have never needed more than 3. Your standard e-commerce company is tracking purchase. Maybe add to cart, maybe something else. Your standard lead gen business, if it's, say, a software as a service company, you're tracking, you know, lead, then marketing qualified lead, sales qualified lead, closed deal, something like that. So you're tracking a few different events down the sales pipeline. You have up to 8 now to be able to track. Now, with that, advertisers will have to choose the order of importance of how they value these different events. And specifically, you have to choose your most important event. And I'll explain why this is relevant in a second. For an e-commerce store, you will choose purchase, because that's probably the most important thing to you. Like, you probably value your purchase events more than your add-to-cart events. For the SaaS company that has a multi-step conversion flow, that's a little bit more of a complicated situation. Depending on your conversion volume, you might end up only being able to track leads, unfortunately. Now, you have to do that. You have to set the order of events. Now, what this means, when people, users, opt out of tracking, it impacts the amount of data that Facebook can track on these people. Data is used in two ways. It is used to report back to the advertiser on performance. It is also used to fuel optimization via machine learning. So when people opt out of tracking, they're basically opting out and saying, like, I don't want to be tracked anymore. Okay, fine. However, with Conversions API, with your verified domain, and when you set up your 1 of 8 conversion actions and choose which one you convert on, which one you care about most, you will still be able to, at the very least, report on the conversion actions that make the most impact to your business, that mean the most to you. So you will still be able to see for your e-commerce store, how many Facebook ads led to a purchase. You won't get that information in real time, and you won't be able to track it down to the ad set level, and you won't be able to do the 28-day view anymore, or 28-day click. It'll have to be within a 7-day time horizon. But for the most part, you will be able to track all of your customer purchases that came back, whether or not somebody opted into or out of tracking. And that's good news for advertisers. That's good news for brands. You will be able to at least report on the amount of revenue that your Facebook ads are generating. The second consideration is that it impacts optimization, because really Facebook can't use that data to fuel and improve your optimization over time. So that's going to get more complicated. That just makes your job as an advertiser harder. Remarketing pools are going to be smaller because people are opting out of tracking. Interest targeting is going to be less accurate. The predicted conversion rate algorithms are going to be a little bit hungrier, I guess, so to speak. They're not going to have as much data to make accurate conversions. It's going to make your job harder, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's impossible. So the two different dynamics here, you have reporting, which can be solved regardless of whether or not people opt in or out. And then you have optimization, which will be impacted, but not necessarily thrown away altogether. Isaac, do you have anything to add on either of those points?
No. I think that there's still a lot of opacity around how this is different between iOS apps and, let's say, like using Chrome or a web browser on an iOS device, and like some of these measures that Facebook has taken, like how exactly do they relate to this iOS 14 update specifically? Like, we just don't know the inner workings of it. And like some, for something like conversion windows, for example, where we're going to be, you know, Facebook's going to be reporting conversions on a 7-day click window and a 1-day view window, and that was, you know, you used to be able to do it on a 28-day window. Like, why is that change happening? My best guess is because Facebook needs to have a reporting system that just works for regular people. And while the conversions being reported are not totally impact, they're only partially impact, meaning the ones that would be tracked through iOS devices, as opposed to, let's say, you know, desktop conversions are going to be, would be, you know, eligible still for accurate 28-day window converting. Facebook's making decisions that are just sort of more global. Like, you know, like, look, we're not going to have like separate desktop, not iOS 14 and this. So, like, Facebook's making a lot of decisions that take this, meaning iOS 14 is impactful enough that Facebook's making some global decisions to simplify and make reporting still make sense for the regular person without, you know, too many complications or fracturing the reporting too much into too many different buckets.
And it's possible that these are conversations that took place behind closed doors between Facebook and Apple. Like, that may have been a concession, right? I was shocked when I found out that you can still report on conversions for people that opt out, given this certain, you know, the ranking. I was surprised on that. And maybe that was a result of a concession that Facebook made by saying, look, for anybody, we're not tracking 28-day
click to Facebook. Right.
Yeah, yeah. Like a mutual concession. Like, we're not going to do this. Can you give us this data? Can you allow us to tap into this aspect of the IDFA? So that's probably what happened. And I think it's... So the other side of this is... The other part of the concession is that this data is going to be delayed. So when people do opt out, you will only get data, conversion data, 3 days after the purchase takes place. Apple will essentially, you made the analogy earlier, Isaac, of opening the dam and letting the data flow back through. Apple will only open the dam 3 days after an event takes place. And that's supposed to, like, this makes it more... It makes it less individualized. It makes it more like in a group. They're going to basically batch a group of conversion data back to your Facebook system to obfuscate it a little bit, as much as they possibly can. So if a conversion takes place on Monday and a user buys a product on your site, even though that user has opted out of Facebook IDFA tracking, on Thursday, you will be able to see that conversion action reported on in your Facebook platform. Which is different, though, if a user converted on Monday on an Android device or on a web app, that will come back immediately. So this is going to really confuse a lot of advertisers and their clients when they're looking at, hey, look, like we spent $10,000 yesterday and like what's going on? Like there's a huge variance in terms of what's being reported in the platform. Like, yeah, because we're not getting a lot of our data until 3 days after, which I'm personally excited about because after this learning curve takes place, it's going to force clients to not just be so, you know, crazy as far as like individual one day performance. It's going to force people to look at a longer time horizon, which is what we've wanted all along. And so I think, you know, there's not a lot, like, we still don't know a lot of information. We still don't know a lot of what's taking place here. But what I can say is that for the most part, most advertisers will be okay. Facebook and Google are still extremely valuable platforms. Google, obviously, probably more than Facebook in the future. But Facebook, they still command a lot of attention. They get a lot of eyeballs, and they still have a very powerful advertising platform. This is going to force them to have to get better. So I think that there's good things to come out of this. I'm also right. excited because I think this is good news for agencies. This whole thing is becoming very challenging, which makes the value of an agency tenfold. And then just the whole reason that this is a little bit different is because this is really impacting the mobile gaming industry, which is like a whole separate conversation. But like those people that were able to track you're advancing to level 2 in Temple Run, you bought for 40 cents a new skin in Fortnite or however much they, all those different like incremental things that you were able to track on a 28 day horizon, that now goes away. That whole industry is being completely turned upside down. But if you don't run a mobile gaming site, and if you're just a standard advertiser that runs ads on Facebook, you will be able to figure this out, or your agency will be able to figure this out. It'll just take some time and a little bit of new habits and some weird reporting modules and correlation studies to be able to prove the efficacy of your campaigns.
Love it. I'll close this out, or you'll get the final words, but I'll go on my soapbox for a minute. And I think I feel similar to you. Overall, I'm happy about these changes. I think it's a great thing for the industry. And here's why. There's a balance between, let me start with this. Good advertising used to be a result of solving complex problems, figuring out business problems, and figuring out how to economically communicate the value of your products and services to customers. It was about value. What mobile advertising has become is this really out of control proliferation of arbitrage, where you have mobile game. Look, 95% of global app revenue is from the mobile gaming industry, and that's a huge number, 95%. And if you think about what's happening, is first, besides, if you, there's a whole conversation that could be had about children, who are, by the way, not typically the customers that you want to target anyway, because they're not buying anything, and they certainly are not interested in being exposed to like a product. But that's not even what's happening in this world. In this world of arbitrage, it's you're playing a game and you're being advertised another game, and when you get that game, you're being advertised another game. So now a whole army of developers worldwide are trying to find the next permutation of something mindless. They're spending a ton of money on user acquisition, but just enough that the amount of ad revenue they can get by selling you the next more mindless game is like a one penny margin. And that's now a $60 billion industry. That's not advertising. Right, that's not advertising. That's, to me, exploiting the allure of antisocial behavior in children and teenagers and adults, actually, if you look at probably the Candy Crush Saga user pool, and exploiting it for profit with nothing more than just another flashy appeal and another app download one click away. And that's really – and I'm not saying these are bad people. I'm not. Like, I'm not saying that I don't – I wish anything. I'm not saying I wish or root for the demise of people making an income by creating mobile games. I have nothing wrong with it. But as an advertiser and in the advertising industry, I think it went so far in the other direction that it no longer even is advertising. It's like I said, it became a whole scheme of our low cost arbitrage. If you're a product or you're a service or you're a B2B or you're selling goods and you've been using Facebook ads, you're still going to be able to do that. And you're going to be forced to not use all of these technologies as a crutch as much as you've used them in the past. And we've seen that where brands get really, they get excited about these individualized, you know, targeting capabilities that these ad networks tout, and it blinds them from fundamental flaws in their business, in their product. It diverts attention and energy away from improving value and figuring out how to communicate that value economically. That's what advertising is about. And I'm all for leveraging flocks and personas and interest groups, but none of that's going away. None of that's going away at all. You'll still, if you're somebody who's willing to think critically about a business and figure out where this market is, what do they want, how are you going to provide them value, you're going to do very, very well, like you said. So it's going to be, I think it's a very good thing for agencies, but also for advertising. And that doesn't mean, and listen, I think it's great. Like, there's so many apps. There's too many apps because they're all free and they're all being monetized by this arbitrage model. But so more apps should be thinking, and I'm not saying that, like, look, broadcast TV with really good ads. And to me, the Super Bowl is a great model because people really think for a long time about how to make these ads enjoyable and useful and interesting. And if I was reading, you know, back in the day of where print advertising reigned supreme, I had a magazine, and I was able to read interesting ads about new products that I didn't know existed, and they were informative. We actually have one from Leo Burnett with the beetle hanging up framed in our wall, and like that's advertising. And there's a place for free supported by advertising, like public utilities and things that are really useful, like broadcast television and like Facebook, for example, by the way. It's free, so that goes into a whole other example of everyone complaining about targeting. But there's also a place that more app developers should think about creating better apps that people are actually willing to pay a few dollars a month for. That would be nice. I'm happy to pay a couple dollars a month for a really good app. I don't need a thousand mindless apps on my phone that are monetized by advertising. And then I'll end with a story that I thought of that as I was thinking about this over the last couple of weeks, I remember reading this story in Claude Hopkins' book, My Life in Advertising. I hope I'm not infringing on any copyright laws here by reading a paragraph from it, but I've bought enough copies that I should be good.
You literally gave out 30 copies at a speech that you gave a few years ago as if it was your own book.
Yeah. So Claude Hopkins eventually left Grand Rapids, where he did very, very well with Bissell. That's a separate story. And he went to work for Swift & Company. And they sold in those days a product called Cotta Suet. And it was a lard. And it was a lard that was used as a replacement for butter. It was like a rendered animal compound lard. And Cottaline was its biggest competitor. They had like the biggest, you know, part of the market. And here, I'll read what he says. We opened a sales office in Boston and started advertising in New England. We had hardly started when Mr. L.F. Swift came to my desk one day. He said, "Father is very nervous about this money spent in advertising. He considers it an utter waste. The results so far are not very encouraging. You have been here nearly 6 weeks, but our sales on Cotta Suet have hardly increased at all." I had no need to explain to him. He knew that advertising had hardly started, but I saw that I had to help him out by making some quick showing. That night after dinner, I paced the streets. I tried to analyze myself. I had been a great success in Grand Rapids, and I was making a fizzle here. What were the reasons? What was there? What did I do there in a different field, in a different company, that I could apply to my new company's problems. At midnight, look, he's pacing the streets. It's midnight. He's thinking. He's analyzing. At midnight, I thought of an idea. So he eventually went and approached Rothschild & Co., I'm going to skip a few paragraphs, which is a huge department store, and he negotiated with the marketing manager of this big department store that on the fifth or the third or fifth story, he's going to have a bakery, and he didn't even have the bakery yet, build a huge cake, and he was going to use kata suet as for the cake base instead of butter, and he was going to give out like samples. People would have to climb the stairs, whatever, to the fifth floor of the department store, and he would give out samples, and the claim would be like, look, if this is better than butter, then it's got to be better than Cottoline and the other competitors, and that was his idea, and he was going to have make a whole show about it. My idea was to make a cake with kata suet in place of butter, then to argue that a product better than butter was certainly better than lard. Mr. Jones, who was from Rothschild, accepted my proposition. Then I went next door to the H.H. Colsot & Co. Bakers and asked them to bake the cake. I told them to make the special tins which were necessary to decorate the cake in a magnificent way and to build it as high as the room. They did so. He eventually went. There was a huge sea of people outside the department store, barricaded by police. During the next week, 105,000 people climbed four flights of stairs to that cake. The elevators could not carry them. There I had demonstrators to offer samples of the cake. Then we had prizes to offer to those who guessed nearest the weight. But every guesser had to buy a pail of kata suet. And then he then went on across all... Then he himself went with people from Swift & Company to all the other states on the Eastern Seaboard, including New York and a bunch of other ones. And he came up with a different variation on this plan, and by the end of the year, kata suet had the lard market, and Cottonelle was out of business, basically. So to me, it's like this was a man pacing the streets, thinking about a problem, analyzing himself, his own flaws, thinking about the product, value, how to communicate this, and he came up with a solution. Now, that's a far cry from where we are in advertising today, but that's the other side of the gamut of what in-app advertising today has become. So I think any movement back in that direction, back towards the center, where you could use technology and you could use complex problem solving, is to me a very good thing. So that's my overarching feeling about the iOS 14 updates and how it's going to impact the industry.
Very good. I would say for further reading, if you are a marketer advertiser that runs ads on Facebook, I definitely recommend a podcast called E-Commerce Influence. Look for episode number 292. They talk about iOS 14, this whole update. They talk about it more at a technical level with like some optimization techniques. And at least one of the guys is from a company called Foxwell Digital. They have a blog that has a lot of really good useful content. So if you're running ads on Facebook and you need some optimization techniques and more descriptions about what Conversions API is and all that other good stuff that we talked about, check out that website. We'll link to it. The other thing I'll say is if you're interested in this overall topic and the privacy debate as a whole, Eric Sufert, he runs Mobile Dev Memo. He also has a podcast you can check out. He goes through this stuff pretty in depth. And then from an overall tech perspective, Ben Thompson's been covering this stuff on Stratechery in depth. So there's a lot more to come on this. Again, like we're still at the early stages of what this entire transition and new world is going to look like. But to Isaac's point, I'm excited about this. It's going to be hard. It's going to be challenging. And there's probably going to be some, you know, frustration and crying along the way. But I'm excited for the opportunity to be able to go into this new era. I think it'll be better for users. I think it'll be better for advertisers. I'm excited to be a part of it. Thank you for the opportunity. I think that's it.
One more important question for you, Patrick.
Yeah.
Where's the best place to hide a dead body?
Second page of Google. Or inside of a cookie. I don't know.
Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you on the next episode.